Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio Podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, John Nichols from The Nation magazine will explain why ceding too much authority to the executive branch has led to an imperial presidency. Fadi Quran from Avaaz joins us to discuss how Facebook and other social media platforms have become the epicenter for misinformation and how we can work in solving the issue. And my own doctor, David LeMay, will be here to discuss why overall health is such an important factor in the battle against COVID-19. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor. Support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to start the show off with the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So Heather, we're all settling in on some level to this new normal, at least that I think we all hope is as temporary as possible. There are some people apparently who have not settled in or are still, I guess, you know, howling at the moon a little bit. And unfortunately, these people are governors. They are sometimes presidents, and they are looking to, I guess, ultimately, you know, salvage the economy in one way as opposed to another way. And I think this is really, and you know, we're going to be talking obviously about the sort of push to open up, as they call it, our economy and go back to business, as if that's the only way to maintain the economy and the economic well-being of Americans. And I want to make it clear as we go into this, and we will, you know, this conversation dovetails with the most recent, I guess, addendum to coronavirus aid in terms of economic help, that these are policy decisions. We are not faced with a sort of binary choice of stay inside or stay, you know, semi-quarantine and or have people be able to eat and live their lives. There are other choices we could be making as a society that we are not. So people have to understand that as we start into this conversation, that this is not simply a binary choice between saving lives and, if you will, saving lives and saving the economy. There's other options. We just choose not to pursue them as a country. And we can talk about that, but it's been rather extraordinary as far as I'm concerned to watch over the course of the past, like, week and a half, Donald Trump encouraging these protests, and we'll talk about those, and then finally getting a bunch of red states to form their own compact. Let's just call it, for the sake of ease, the Confederacy, and them basically deciding that they're going to start the process of allowing people to engage in fairly normal activities, ostensibly under these sort of weird, impossible to maintain rules. And then to watch the president turn around and sort of like undercut those governors who are doing this, it's been sort of fascinating.
It's been extremely fascinating. And I, you know, the Trump reaction, I think, I mean, we'll get into the details of what's going on there, but just that particular thing of him turning on them, I think, is the most interesting. If there's a better illustration of the folly of being a Trump cultist, it's that, because he has absolutely zero loyalty. He didn't even try to defend Kemp, the Georgia governor who he turned on in his coronavirus rally that he had, and they asked him about the decision to open up, and he absolutely threw Kemp under the bus. And that just shows you, you know, where you are if you're, you know, a Trump cultist. You are just a tool for him in the moment, and he has absolutely no personal loyalty to you. And of course, on the bigger question, as you say, this is, you know, this is a real test. I think that the Confederacy compact that they have formed is you know, serving as, you know, kind of an experiment, a petri dish to see how many people they can kill with, you know, without the whole state rebelling. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of that they would do, that why they would do this. There's another thing. And that is that if they can get these people, if they can open up these businesses and, you know, what they're calling, you know, in Georgia, opening up tattoo parlors and hairdressers and the kind of things that are just really intimate interactions with other people, nothing right. could be crazier than that in this moment. And and Georgia hasn't even come close to fulfilling the Trump guidelines on what you can have when, you know, what you should, where you should be before you start opening up, much less opening up these kinds of businesses. It's just, it's just nihilistic and strange that he would do that to his own people. But Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, is really not the sharpest tool in the shed. I mean, he really is not. And I think that may be, apparently he didn't even tell his own task force that he was going to do it. He just did it. You know, I was watching Fox, I guess, and decided to do it. But in any case, that one of the reasons, if there is one that's a bit more, you know, strategic on their part, it's that they, if they open up businesses and people refuse to go back to work, they can yes. deny them unemployment. And if businesses refuse to open up, they can deny them loans and other things that, that, you know, might keep, get them over the hump. And a big part of this on the Republican side, I mean, they are absolutely behaving in evil fashion here, is money. I mean, they just really do not want to spend it. And it goes to what you were saying earlier, these choices that we, that the country has. And the United States is in a unique position to do the right thing here because we have our own currency. This is not something that we should even be thinking about in terms of spending as much money as possible to keep people up. I mean, we've got, what was it this week, 26 million people on unemployment now. I mean, it's practically unprecedented. And you know, we're in, this is a totally unusual situation. None of the normal rules should apply, and in including that, which is that, you know, at this point, the federal government just needs to keep people with roofs over their heads, money coming in so that they can feed their families, and keep some semblance of the normal order financially so that when we get to this point where we can gradually reopen so that people aren't having to take their lives in their hands just to go out to, you know, work every day, that you can come back to it without, you know, a horrible, horrible hangover of people having lost everything. But instead, the Republicans seem to be intent upon using this as a way to force people into bankruptcy. I mean, Mitch McConnell even wanted to force, is now saying he wants states to go into bankruptcy. I mean, this is crazy talk. It's crazy talk. And yet, here we are in a unique situation where we could totally do the right thing, do it with ease, really. It's not that hard. They just go to Washington. They start signing checks. It's really not that hard. And then gradually do everything that the public health experts are saying, gradually reopen and do this, and, you know, to the point where we can function again over the course of time as the virus is somehow, you know, I mean, there's nothing we can do about the virus other than trying to keep people from getting it, and to try and keep the health system functional so that they can take care of people who do have it and try to get all the, you know, treatments and vaccines and everything else going as quickly as possible. But in the meantime, you know, this is the job of the government, the federal, all of the governments, but the federal government in particular can just write checks. And, you know, this, so far, you know, they've kind of done the minimum. And I just have a feeling we're going to run up against a wall here as you see these governors experimenting in their states with things like telling people, hey, you know, we opened it up. You can go back to work. If you refuse, it's on you.
Right.
And the individual will then have to make this decision for themselves. And it's just, it's absolutely nihilistic and cruel. I mean, I, you know, I'm lucky I work from home anyway, but, you know, if I was forced to face that situation of having to go back to work or, you know, lose everything, you know, I don't know what I would do. I mean, I just don't know. It's awful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have this dynamic in Florida where they have paid an infinitesimally, I've seen numbers anywhere ranging from like 4 to 15% of the unemployment claims are being paid in Florida. And part of it is that Rick Scott set 14%? Up a system. 14%. And I think that could be even higher than it actually is. You know, that's just in terms of people who have been able to file claims since March 15th. So 14% of those people. But one of the things we know about Florida, and we saw stories about this early on, was that Rick Scott set it up so that it was very hard to file claims. So you could be unemployed, but not be able to file a claim because you've got to file it in triplicate. You've got to go back. And you, I mean, just they create all these obstacles so that they do not get the statistics that make them look like there's unemployment. And they did that under Rick Scott because they don't want to pay. And so we're probably looking at something that is closer to like 7% of the actual claims that exist in Florida. And Georgia has a very similar dynamic. They're up to close to, I've seen reports, maybe a million unemployed in that state in the past 4 or 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to pay these unemployment claims. That's exactly right. And people should understand this is, and when Mitch McConnell says, yeah, let's let the states and the municipalities go bankrupt, this is all part of the same sort of austerity program, right? Like this is, we're going to keep taxes low. Georgia did that, one of those like sort of Kansas style, we're going to cut taxes and we'll get more revenue. And that did not happen. We're going to keep taxes low and we're going to use this as an excuse of, and this is the thing that, you know, and I had promised myself I wasn't going to get upset. But this is the thing that really gets me angry, because from day one, from minute one, from second one, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are, and they haven't land, they don't necessarily land on it, but they're immediately into a mode of how can we take this event and create structural change out of it? You know, we heard a lot about in the Democratic primary of like, you know, of people talking about structural change, who's actually going to make structural change. We want structural change. The reality is that the Republicans are excellent at this. And they know that the way that you do it is you create certain facts on the ground, you frame them in certain ways, and then you just let the chips fall where they may. So Mitch McConnell is looking to cut things like public sector pensions. Right. Yeah. For teachers, for police officers, for firemen, for city workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. State workers, we want to cut their pensions because that means that we can cut taxes on wealthy people in the states. And so by forcing, by jamming them like this, you know, there was no funding for states in or municipalities in any of these bailouts. The Democrats had to parade around like they were champions because they got money for hospitals. Well, the Republicans want to withhold money from hospitals so that cities and towns and states are drained of money to support their public hospitals. I mean, they are trying to restructure the way that state governments work so that, again, rich people get more money, get basically more free services from their states. You know, that's when we say cut taxes on wealthy people. What we're really saying is we're giving them free services, giving them more free services, whether it's roads for their businesses, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's an educated population, et cetera, et cetera. We're giving them more free services. And this is the game that they're playing. And on the Democratic side, and I didn't want to get here this quickly, frankly, but on the Democratic side, you know, Nancy Pelosi has to get basically shredded by everybody because she's the only thing that she's doing publicly is going on television and bragging about how much ice cream she has for her family in her unbelievably expensive twin set of refrigerators on national TV. And now, you know, she came out earlier this week on Wednesday, I guess, and said, no more Mr. Nice Guy. Well, I'm sorry. Did you think that Mitch McConnell was playing tiddlywinks through this? Like, I mean, where have these people been? And, you know, we're supposed to believe that now she's going to get tough because Mitch McConnell's gone out of bounds. No, she's getting tough because she messed up on national television all the while doing nothing and is realizing that there's some political blowback for this. Because on day one, if you don't realize that Mitch McConnell is not your friend in an event like this, after him telling Barack Obama, we're not saying anything about Russia influence, about Merrick Garland, about shoving through all these judges. Like, I don't know what it takes for, you know, and that's just giving her the benefit of the doubt of just being dim, as opposed to just not really caring about or afraid of any type of structural change. Case in point, we're going to subsidize COBRA instead of expanding Medicaid. That's the most expensive possible way you could do this. And the only reason why they want to do that is because after the crisis is over, supposedly, they can just pull back that support of COBRA and nothing changes. And this is just, this is, it really is beyond misfeasance into malfeasance. And of course, you know, the Republicans are horrible. But, you know, at what point does Nancy Pelosi realize this? I think she already has. And she's sort of like using that as an excuse, unless it makes her look bad. I'm off topic a little bit because I still want to talk about this sort of pressure by the Republicans to open up. But I mean, this is, we're just making choices as a society. And when one side is pushing the narrative to make one choice and the other side is pretending like no choice is being made, we're just making a choice as a society.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, this all does tie in. I mean, the fact, what you say is absolutely correct about, you know, the Democrats' ongoing, you know, impotence. And I don't even know what to say about it. I don't think Nancy Pelosi's naive. I don't think any of the Democratic leadership is naive. But for whatever reason, that they seem to, and I cannot think of any other way to think about it, they cannot grasp that Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership, and I'm not even talking about Trump here. This has nothing to do with Trump. Has his own thing that's separate from all this that has to do with Trump only. This is the Republican project that I'm talking about here. That it's exactly as you say. It's like disaster capitalism only for, you know, for government. Creating this structural change, using this, these crises for their own purposes. And Mitch McConnell and those leaders on that side, they are like terrorists. They take hostages of the American people. They are happy to see the hostages shot. This is the metaphor that works for the, in this situation, that you cannot negotiate with that in any sort of reasonable fashion. I really believe the Democrats, because they know these people and they socialize, they see each other in the hall, they do whatever, they think that they're operating from a position of, you know, that they actually do care about people in some level, that they are, you know, like normal human beings. They are not. Mitch McConnell is not a normal human being. He just isn't. I'm sorry. He's an empty, soulless, the gravedigger of democracy is the perfect way to describe him. I don't know what kind of evil he is or where it comes from, but it exists. And if you do not understand that about him, that they are willing to see people suffer and die in order to enact their agenda, you can't responsibly or in any way effectively try and stop them, number one, or to advance your own agenda. You have to at least grapple with that fact. And I just don't think I just don't see it. I don't see that they actually get that yet. This is after decades now, Sam. I mean, we've been talking about this stuff for a long time. It has nothing to do with Trump. It has nothing to do. This is their project. Their project. And when we're looking at what's going to happen with the American economy going forward in this crisis, what I see what this is analogous to is what happened in Europe after the financial crisis, where the Eurozone, where they actually, you know, they look what they did to Greece and Spain and some of the other countries there with austerity. They basically decided to teach them a lesson, right? I mean, this was like, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to pay the piper now. This is going to they'll teach you, don't get too much debt, don't do this, that, and the other. And they created a mountain of suffering in those countries and, you know, were partially responsible before the migration that happened from the Middle East. I mean, there was a lot of fallout from that. I mean, obviously, the situation in the United States is different, but they're treating it. When you see Mitch McConnell come out and say, put out a memo that's titled Stopping Blue State Bailouts, that's what we're talking about here, because when he wants to say we're going to get rid of the pension obligations, we're going to make them, you know, default on their pension obligations, you see Nikki Haley coming out with tweets saying, well, these governments needed to be responsible, and now they're going to have to pay. That's the attitude here.
She came out with tweets saying they have to be responsible like businesses who save for a rainy day. Every sector that we have bailed out, starting with the airlines, took every single extra penny they had, and they put it right in their pockets years ago with stock buybacks. So the idea, I mean, they were making billions. Their CEOs were saying things like, we may never lose money again. Talk about acting like business. If the government acted like business, what we would have is, a lot of, like, I guess, taxpayers just walking away with a small number of taxpayers walking away with a ton of cash. That they have extracted out of our
lieutenant governors having gigantic windfalls every year, bonuses.
Here's the thing that I'm having trouble with, because you and I have had, it seems to me, the same conversation about Nancy Pelosi and about the Democrats, like you say, for decades now. And the idea that she could be naive to this is just, I'm sorry, I do not believe it. Now, maybe she is, but either way, it's like, you know, for me, the Democratic Party has always been the most effective tool of, you know, the very limited number of tools that we have that in terms of, like, political parties to pursue, an agenda. And, you know, maybe Nancy Pelosi is completely naive. Maybe she's just like, you know, has some type of ideological problem with things like, you know, we could never, ever get away from COBRA. But either way, it's like, as a tool, I need a hammer and she's a wet noodle. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, at one point, it doesn't matter. Like, I felt quite strongly when Tim Ryan was challenging her leadership, like, man, oh, man, we don't want somebody who doesn't know what he's doing. And this guy's politics are not so great. Like, you know what? Maybe we do. Maybe we would be better off at this point in terms of Democratic leadership with someone who doesn't know what they're doing, someone who doesn't know enough to say we're not going to hold votes. Actually, even though we had planned to allow members to vote in absentia, because I want total control of what we're doing. Maybe Tim Ryan wouldn't be so savvy to know that. Like, it's unclear to me that the value of Nancy Pelosi's savvy is really helping in this situation. You know what I mean?
You may be right about that. I mean, it's possible that maybe the habit of negotiation in the way that it's been done over the past, I mean, you know, and she's had wins and losses. It's not, you know, she's not just been totally inept all the way along. But I think that maybe this habit of, you know, I mean, they're looking at this, and I feel for the Democrats, I really do, because they were facing in this last round on the extension of the CARE Act for small business that, you know, you're looking at millions and millions of people just losing their businesses, just gone, it's over, can't do anything, we're not going to get it back if they didn't get these loans. So there's a sort of Damocles hanging over their heads with, you know, you've got nihilist Mitch McConnell over here saying, yeah, whatever, we don't care. You know, I mean, that's a tough position to be in.
It's a tough position if you set it up as the dynamic is like, we won't give you this. How about this? Mitch McConnell, why are you capping at $250 billion? Why is there a cap at all? This thing has been completely mishandled. We need to save small businesses. Republicans won't do it. We want an unlimited cap. No cap on this. I mean, like, the way they're approaching this is exactly the way you would go about it if you really didn't want to succeed. Like, there has been The loan program is a disaster, right? Like, the amount of money that went out is a drop in the bucket. You had maybe 4% of small businesses getting a loan or a grant. And who knows how much of that limited money was chewed up by companies that have CEOs that are making over $1 million, by companies that have, you know, millions of dollars in revenue. And so, you know, the Democrats come in and they're like, well, we need to get, you know, some for hospitals. We need to have 60 million, 60 billion of that 380 billion goes to low income folks, or goes to minority borrowers and whatnot. That's great. Absolutely necessary. But how about saying this? Unlimited. Unlimited. We won't vote for anything that doesn't actually help the American public. Like, they are trapped both in the Republican frame and their frame. Like, they are inhibiting their ask based upon a Republican frame of austerity. When they don't say we need, why have no cap? All it does is set Mitch McConnell up to do what he did this week and come out and say, like, you know, now we're actually going to start worrying about how much money we're spending. Because the Democrats were carrying half that water through this whole process anyways.
Agreed. And nothing could have been, you know, we could have seen this coming. There was bound to be some kind of an economic crisis on the way, right? I mean, there always is something happening. And the Democrats not taking advantage of this situation where you had Mitch McConnell and the Republicans happily signing off on gigantic tax cuts and gigantic military spending, running up the deficit to, what was it, $3 trillion under Trump before this happened, and saying not a word, and not using that as saying, look, the economy is going great, and yet we have this deficit. Gee, look at that. Maybe it doesn't really matter. I mean, to just completely turn it on a dime, you know, I mean, it's changed the way Americans think about this. I mean, I've had this problem with even my friends trying to explain, and I'm no MMT expert or any of that, and I don't really want to get into it, but I'm just saying, look, we have evidence right now that this, we've got incredibly, we have no inflation, no interest, you know, super low interest rates. We've got a deficit that's soaring beyond belief, and yet somehow none of the fallout that is supposed to come from that is happening. So that should not be a concern. And even more than that, even if you're just a normal person, we're in the midst of an unprecedented crisis. And the idea that anybody would have allowed Mitch McConnell to come out and even utter those words without there being a massive primal scream coming across the Democratic Party is really, really unfortunate.
What was Nancy Pelosi pushing a year and a half ago? She was pushing PAYGO. She was pushing PAYGO. Well, she is a Pete Peterson. She is a Pete Peterson acolyte. And so when we get into situations like this, I mean, she is a Pete Peterson acolyte. That to you and I sounds like an insult, but it's actually just a reality that she would embrace. This is the problem that we have now, is that we're trying to push against this incredibly malignant force of the Republican Party, and we're doing it with a limp piece of pasta. She accepts the entire framing that the Republican Party is using to essentially destroy any type of infrastructure, social infrastructure. And it's enraging. And there's no one now. Chuck Schumer's not going to do it. Joe Biden's not going to do it. There's nobody. There's nobody.
There is a progressive caucus, you know. I mean, you know, are they out there saying anything?
The only one so far who say anything specific has been AOC, and they're not going to have the opportunity to be held account for not voting for this because Nancy Pelosi refuses to allow a vote on anything. She refuses to set up an apparatus to have votes. She refuses to set up an apparatus to have any type of oversight. I mean, this is the type of control that Obama exercised running, you know, in that summer of 2008, where he's going to shut everything down except for him. And we're supposed to trust them. And frankly, you know, it doesn't work. It's not working. And it's infuriating. And you know, we're not seeing the outcry from anybody. And it's driving me nuts. It's driving me nuts. And honestly, like, I don't know what the answer is. The answer is not, we're going to vote for a third party, but there needs to be more agitation against Nancy Pelosi. And she clearly just in the, at least performatively this week came out like, no more Mr. Night Guy. You know, we saw the, well, I don't know if it was Politico or whatever, you know, piece was dropped. And that was because she realized how horrible she was in that James Corden video where, you know, with her ice cream combined with everything else, it couldn't have been a better metaphor. But I this is not where I want to go with this, but I'm sorry. I mean, this is just absurd. It's absurd. It's just patently absurd. And, you know, there's no, we should be hearing from Sanders and Warren and, you know, it just everybody has been bought into this notion of we'll do nothing and Donald Trump will lose on his own, which may be the case. But the fact of the matter is you're going to be completely screwed 2 years from now, just like we were under Obama, if you do not set up an apparatus in which to do something.
That is true. This is if anybody's thinking beyond November, and they should be, because this problem that has been created, first of all, the virus isn't going to go away on its own. This is going to be something that could be with us for quite some time. But even beyond that, the fallout, the carnage that this thing has caused on its own, and on Trump's ineptitude and the Congress's inability to actually, you know, force the kinds of mitigation that would have been, that maybe would have made things better, the fallout is going to be absolutely epic if Joe Biden does become president, if they do take back the Senate, all the sort of optimistic views of what happens. The job that is going to be left for them is going to be horrific. And the idea, if they're not setting it up right now, as a, you know, using this, I shouldn't say using it. I mean, that makes it sound like it's opportunistic, but, and it's not.
Leveraging the crisis.
Exactly. If they don't understand that this crisis is being made far worse by all this stuff, and that they have to look ahead and see that, you know, the education of the American public on things like public debt, the absolute, you know, the total destruction of the Mitch McConnell project, that those things are going to require a new way of thinking. They can't just sit here and go, you know, well, we're negotiating, you know, we're working it out, we're getting in a room, we're hashing out the problem. That is not going to, that it's not adequate to the job. It's not, the job is going to be far, far more, you know, onerous than anything we've ever dealt with before, I think. And this is completely unique, and it's going to require fresh thinking. And I think that that's what you're talking about, really. I mean, we're talking about a leadership, and this is going to be true in the White House, it's going to be true in the Congress, that is, you know, it is absolutely paralyzed and sort of frozen in amber in thinking that is not adequate to the task, that it's from the past, and there has to be some fresh thinking here. And I'm sure that it's happening. I'm sure there are Democrats out there, and not just AOC, who I think is great, but I think there are others that must be thinking along these lines, that this is going to take a completely different approach to dealing with the Republicans and to dealing with these kinds, the scope of these problems. I mean, even the most, you know, ossified person, like, you know, that believes somewhat in, you know, in Keynesian economics, would say that this is a moment that you write blank checks, right? I mean, nothing could be more obvious. And yet we're arguing over, you know, limiting the amount of money that we give to small businesses. No, you write blank checks. This is what you do.
But here's the thing, is that when it comes to writing blank checks for the insurance companies, like, I mean, this is my point about the COBRA. I mean, COBRA is the most expensive insurance product that exists. There is no other. It's just automatically marked up by 25%. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's no. We don't have another insurance product that costs more than this. So if you were really worried about the deficit and the debt, you would say, let's expand Medicaid. Let's expand Medicaid. And you could say, now, they're afraid to do it because they're afraid it won't be temporary. They're afraid that if they do it, that too many people are going to want it after, you know, we're back into some type of like normalcy. But who knows when that'll be, right? I mean, honestly, like, who knows? We don't know. We've got now, what, close to 30 million people out of work. Another 4 or 5 million this week. And there's no reason to believe that we're not going to see 3 to 4 million, you know, just on a normal trajectory. And then at one point, there's going to be another wave where it bumps back up to 6 million. Like, we're going to get to 40 million unemployed. Now, I don't know. Maybe it's possible because of the nature of the way that this has worked that, you know, 6 weeks later, we open up and 6 weeks later and everybody's got a job and everything's fine. I find that very hard to believe. I also find it very hard to believe that we're going to be able to open up anytime soon. And by soon, I'm talking like, you know, we could be in, you know, we're not talking 2 or 3 months away from on this. And so they are afraid of expanding Medicaid, which would be far cheaper, far easier than actually paying out cash to insurance companies. And that's what they're more afraid of. So, like, on one hand, she's an acolyte of Pete Peterson. She is concerned about PAYGO. On the other hand, when it comes to paying for something that's actually less expensive and is an investment, right, because you're building a structure as opposed to just, you know, looking for disposable buckets in which to put money into, that doesn't happen. I mean, and there's nobody... there's nobody calling her out for this.
Well, I mean, I think it's very, you know, I don't know why that is. It seems unusual. I mean, it's happening in sort of a, you know, low level activist level, I think, you know, on social media you hear it. But I think within the caucus, they seem to be pretty paralyzed. I mean, that's how it looks to me. It looks like this total paralysis. And now I understand on a certain level, you know, you say, of course they should expand Medicaid to everyone who isn't insured. It's just that simple. We're in a health crisis, for crying out loud, you know, but people aren't working. They have no choice. Should just be open up Medicaid. We're going to deal with this. You know, that's fine. But of course, you know, Mitch McConnell will say no, they won't do that. Donald Trump will run with it and say, look at all these communists over here trying to, you know, use the crisis to do whatever. This is where the problem is that Democrats are too afraid of that stuff. They're just too afraid of having Mitch McConnell call them, you know, socialists. They're too afraid of all of that. And honestly, you know, in a normal electoral cycle, in certain districts, you know, the old stint, you know, well, they've got up there in a swing district. They've got to be careful about what they say, blah, blah, blah. That's one thing. This is different. Right now is the moment to be saying this stuff. For the first time in many, 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 many moons, they have an opportunity to make a case to the American people right in the middle of this. We've got pictures of people waving Confederate flags and Nazi flags in the faces of nurses in the middle of the street. We have that. These are Mitch McConnell's people here. These are Donald Trump's people here. Are you one of them? Is that who you are? I mean, this is a moment where Democrats can make dramatic, sweeping statements. I mean, use their, you know, quote, bully pulpit to the extent that they have it, and they do have it. If they want to go on TV, they can. They'll be in any cable news show except Fox will have them on to talk about this and just come out swinging. And they can say this stuff. Now, I don't know whether it will move the legislation, but what it does do is that it prepares the public for a new way of thinking about this stuff. It prepares them for something that goes beyond November and just, you know, gee, Joe Biden, don't say anything, you know, just don't upset the apple cart and we'll squeak through in November and then everything will be fine. It's not going to be fine, and they have got to be preparing the American people for this. And I guess Biden can't do it because he is who he is and they don't want to upset that apple cart and they're worried about legislation. But geez, there has to be somebody out there saying, look, I mean, having people from the Democratic Party out there saying, we need to open up Medicaid and saying, COBRA is completely, it's a ridiculous, moribund system to begin with, and nothing could be more. I mean, how are people supposed to pay for COBRA? You know,
well,
after
that's the
money
point.
Drops? What are they supposed to do? It's $2,000 a month? I mean, that's ridiculous.
It's crazy. Well, I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit more about this angle of what's happening in terms of the pressure from Trump to open up on these governors. And but a lot of it is just a question of like who he can shift blame to and put pressure on the blue states. And that seemed like overnight in a matter of days, like literally two or three days this week, it seemed to shift from the sort of Trump as a using this as a political force, because I think he started to see the polling, started to realize he was on the wrong side of this, and backed off it, undercut Brian Kemp. His guy Collins running for Senate in Georgia backed off it. And who knows, maybe the you know, the attempt by, Betsy DeVos and other Tea Party backers, to get like white supremacists and militias to get out there and protest about these closings. Maybe they back off that way and they try and do it legislatively, like through McConnell, by saying like, OK, we're just not going to bail you out, blue states. We're going to make the blue states hurt. I mean,
exactly.
We will get a better notion next week if there has been this shift or if this was just like a hiccup. In terms of this strategy, because the White House and the Republicans are, despite the complete, I think, failure of Democrats to grasp and seize the moment, they're concerned, and rightly so, about what's going to happen to them in November. But Digby, I know that you will be home next week. I also will be. Thank you as always. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you next week.
You too, Sam. My pleasure.
President Trump's daily press briefings regarding COVID-19 have turned into a workshop on how to become a delusional megalomaniac. Here to discuss why a constant ceding of authority to the executive branch has enabled Trump to make everything worse, John Nichols from The Nation magazine. So, John, it's been, I don't know, an interesting couple of days of the Donald Trump, I don't know what they call it, these pep rallies that he has in the White House briefing room. They are like, I don't know, it's a little bit like performance art. And then every now and then he just says something that is either completely crazy or also sort of shockingly authoritarian. And that was sort of the jumping off point of your piece in The Nation.
That is correct. And I think you're really right to use a reference to performance art, because performance art is art. And people who do it well do it, you know, with a lot of intention. But at the root of it is sort of tapping into yourself quite often. And there's no question that these two-hour rants or hour-and-a-half rants that some of our media still broadcasts without interruption really does tap into Donald Trump. The man is a terrified mess of an ill-formed man who, you know, sort of desperately lashing out and looking for ways to put blame on other people and to try and assert his authority to give direction in a circumstance where he has given no direction. So you get a lot of realization there. But one of the things that I've focused on, and as you kindly note, is that in a number of these recent press briefings, he has repeatedly delivered authoritarian statements. And these are really authoritarian. The suggestion that he has all power over the states, that whatever he says, you know, goes, he calls the shots. Now, he said that a week ago Monday, and then he sort of drew back on it a little bit, you know, but without ever acknowledging that what he had said was fundamentally wrong. And then the next day, after, you know, kind of all this turbulence and sturm and drain, he comes back and talks about perhaps exercising the power to adjourn Congress, literally to put the Congress out of session. And, you know, you start to put all these pieces together, and it's unsettling. It should be unsettling to anyone, because it's clear that in this sort of desperate mess of a moment that he has created and that he's trying to chart, Donald Trump defaults quite frequently to very authoritarian thinking.
I mean, I am sympathetic to the notion that some people have that when people like you and I or anybody talks in this way about his authoritarianism as if he's nothing but a joke, I'm sympathetic that it's like a little bit alarmist. I mean, I'm sympathetic to that. However, it does feel to me like there is a quality. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the video of like of penguins coming off the beach going into the dunes. They come up, then they run back into the water. Then they come up a little further, and then they run back into the water. And then they come up another little further, and they do that for hours until they get to the end of the beach, which you and I could walk there in 30 seconds. And there is a quality to what's going on that I think like numbs us on some level. And absent any sort of like extraneous event, he may never be able to capitalize on this. But one thing that I think must be really clear to people right now is that extraneous, outside, exogenous events happen. And, you know, there's this assumption that people have of like, okay, you know, at one point we're going to come out of this, you know, our stay-at-home orders, and we're just going to go about our business, and there'll be, you know, more financing, and we will come out of the recovery, and it may take longer than we think. As if there's no opportunity for any other events to take place that a guy who has been sort of like almost like it's like tenderizing meat on some level. This notion that he has this power. He's asserted it and asserted it and asserted it. And they're doing stuff now. Like, there's a story this week in the New England Journal of Medicine where you've got FBI agents and Department of Homeland Security agents who are intercepting transport of personal protection equipment that states have procured. And the federal government is taking it and then giving it to private contractors to go and sell on the market. I mean, all of these things add up to almost like a tinderbox, if you will. And we're just sort of waiting for a spark.
Well, you know, look, in this country, we have, if we're honest about our history, many, many examples of points at which presidents of the United States were in a difficult circumstance. And far, in my opinion, far nobler presidents, far more honorable presidents than Donald Trump, were in a difficult circumstance and exercised their powers in extreme ways. Abraham Lincoln, at certain times during the Civil War, was, you know, clearly disrespectful of elements of the Constitution, and particularly as regards, you know, civil liberties. And you can say, well, yeah, it was a civil war, right? You know, there were demands there that forced Lincoln to do some things that were, you know, that history wouldn't look that kindly on. Look at Franklin Roosevelt in the midst of World War II. I mean, can any of us suggest that it wasn't horrific the way that he responded to Japanese Americans and, you know, literally putting people, citizens of this country, and often people whose children were serving in the military, into camps distant from their homes, you know. And so again and again, we have had presidents do things that exercised their powers, or what they thought were their powers, in extreme ways. We should always be on the watch for that. This isn't, you know, being unfair to Donald Trump. It's not, you know, going to some extreme position or some extreme way of thinking. This is simply saying the reality that you know, this threat always exists, that we always worry about it in times of instability or uncertainty in our country. And the troubling thing about Donald Trump is that I genuinely don't think that he's ever read the Constitution of the United States. I find it hard to imagine that he has, because he's shown so much ignorance as regards its basic premises. And I think that he gets counsel from people who tend to be on the side of an imperial presidency, of a president who really can pretty much do what he wants. And again, this isn't new, right? Richard Nixon famously suggested that if the president of the United States did something, that was cool because the president of the United States did it, right? You know, and somehow we should see that as acceptable. But I think Trump has that on steroids. I think that, you know, he looks at maybe a line from Article 1 in the Constitution and says, yeah, I'm the man. I can do whatever I want. He hears some mention about the power of a president to, in a very specific circumstance where the House and the Senate cannot agree on adjournment to, quote unquote, adjourn the Congress, right? And he takes off on that, saying, well, if they don't do what I want, I'm going to adjourn them and start appointing who I want to judgeships and administrative positions. Where the line is between his megalomania and his ignorance is a good debate, right? You know, academic debate, you want to have that sometime, that's fine. But at this moment, there needs to be a lot of pushback against his ignorance and his megalomania. I will give high compliments, incredibly high compliments, to Congressman Justin Amash, a very libertarian-leaning, independent former Republican, and to some other Republicans who have stepped up in just these recent days and said, hey, Mr. President, you don't have those powers. But at a fundamental level, what I would hope is that the Congress of the United States would immediately figure out a way to meet remotely and to be in session on a regular basis and, frankly, providing oversight and pushback on these sorts of issues. Because no matter what you think of Donald Trump, I think that his tendency to over-assess his power is extrapolated, is accelerated by the fact that at this point he seems to have all the platforms. He seems to own the bully pulpit.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's nobody out there saying, hey, hold it.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about this because and let's be clear here. When we say Congress, we're talking about the Democrats. I mean, right.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the Democratic leadership. And the House has, but also, I mean, we could hear this across the board from Democratic leaders. But the House could theoretically at least pass something. It wouldn't necessarily become law, but it would create some type of record. I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, he's out there asserting these things. They go more or less unchallenged in very specific ways. Challenged, you know, maybe it's, you know, Nancy Pelosi hand waving and saying, yeah, he's crazy and whatnot. But they go unchallenged in terms of a governmental, a legislative, a statutory, I mean, even bills. It goes without that type of response. And I guess my concern is that, it's not like, you know, there aren't terrorist organizations who wouldn't be out there saying, like, maybe now would be a good time to hit the United States. Or maybe we enter into a phase where there becomes internal, dissent. And there becomes, I mean, it's not inconceivable that, you know, with what we're talking about in terms of economic deprivation, that we would see protests and perhaps riots. I mean, all of this is possible. I'm not saying it's likely, but I'm saying but if you had asked me 6 weeks ago, was it likely that I'd be in my attic right now with a mock backdrop talking into a microphone in my home, I would say you're out of your mind. And so, you know, I don't think we should confine ourselves to likely events. I think we should go to possible ones. And without there being some type of record, without the Democrats, the opposition party, it's almost like, you know, it's performative on some level, but it's also really important that there is a rhetorical record and a political response to this, because in its absence, there's no way to sort of like crank up the machine and say, hey, whoa, 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 what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you an example of this. And this happens with Democratic and Republican presidents. When you've got a president who seems to be edging toward a military action, if Congress is in session and a lot of members of Congress are stepping up and, you know, using their bully pulpits to say, hold it, you know, this isn't authorized, this isn't appropriate, there have been a number of examples where presidents kind of backed off or at least blinked a little bit in that circumstance. So we know that this system of checks and balances works in two ways. One is the overt way, which is the Senate accepts or rejects a nominee for a position, right? That we know in the kind of classic example. But what we often lose sight of is the dialectic, if you will, the back and forth. And so the executive says something, and there's a lot of pushback from Congress, and it's very clear. And maybe there's a resolution. Maybe there's a committee hearing that investigates or that raises issues. Whatever it is, that back and forth actually is a part of what maintains the balance, which maintains the separation of powers. And so it's easy to be highly critical of Donald Trump in this circumstance. And I think it's appropriate to be highly critical of Donald Trump because I just think he's a lousy president. But at the same time, if you've got a president who you really do understand to be not good at what he does and at times destructive and at times, you know, over the top and all the other criticisms you may have for him, then isn't that exactly the time at which you would want to go immediately to the best tech people in the country and develop a system for remote voting, remote debates, remote hearings, so that Congress can be fully in session the way that state legislatures and city councils across this country are? I mean, it is absurd to me. It is absurd to me that, you know, like my daughter is more actively engaged, you know, with her school government. She's on the principal's advisory committee. They're meeting on the principal's advisory committee at her high school remotely. It would seem to me like the Congress of the United States might be able to muster that level of interaction.
But isn't there a clue there, John, that the Democrats have decided we're sitting this out? I mean, it's quite obvious. There is got to be a technological way for them to set up these things. It could have been done, frankly, weeks ago. And
It
seems like
have been done immediately.
But this is not a competence issue. This is a Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I imagine, and, you know, who knows who else within the Democratic establishment and institutions that have decided the best thing for Democrats to do is stand back. We're just going to, four corners this, as we used to call it in college basketball. We're just going to, you know, we're going to get to the edges of the court and we're just going to run out the clock and we're not going to do anything. And that's seems to me to be an incredibly dangerous strategy, but it also seems to be one that is in some ways sort of is ideological insofar as it's saying, A, there's no urgent problem that we need to deal with. B, there's no urgent problem that we have the power to deal with. I.e., we will not go to extraordinary lengths. And that's basically making an ideological decision that there isn't enough jeopardy for American citizens, whether it's what we've been talking about in terms of Trump's authoritarianism or whether it's something like, hey, you know what? 4 weeks of unemployment just ain't going to cut it. Filling up the coffers of insurance companies by subsidizing COBRA as opposed to expanding Medicaid. That's an ideological decision. And they're using this excuse of like, well, too bad we can't, you know, deliberate on this stuff because there's no such thing as Zoom, or there's no such thing as a webinar, or whatever the excuse is. I mean, this is a real abdication, it seems to me, and a conscious one.
Well, and I'm going to, the only place, and you know, you and I tend to agree on a lot of stuff, but let me suggest one more element of this. When most of Congress is at a distance, right, that gives leadership tremendously more power and flexibility, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of having to deal with everybody, you can basically be in a situation where, yeah, you'll make some time. Somebody could call in and give you an idea, but it's not in the full setting of the House. It's not in the full setting of a committee. And then leadership ends up in a situation, be it Republican or Democratic leadership, where they are negotiating with other leaders or with, you know, Mnuchin over at Treasury or something like that, rather than, you know, having to carry the full opinion, the full energy of the caucus, right? And yep. So it's a very problematic situation where, it's easier not to have a lot of consultation, right?
Of course.
And so even if it's not an abdication, you use the word abdication, and I think, well, to my mind, from a public relations standpoint, it is abdication. But on another level, it is, you know, a very frustrating additional reality that a handful of people, a small handful of people now, are making monumental decisions about where we will have debates and what we will fight about. And that's frustrating because I think they aren't always making the best decisions.
I agree. I mean, that's the thing. There's two elements of this. One, what they're doing is being completely undemocratic and trying to maintain control of the narrative. But the reason why they're doing that is because they are engaged, in my estimation, a conscious abdication of their role, because they think that if the Democrats just disappear, then Donald Trump will get will not be reelected. And maybe they're right and maybe they're wrong. Like, we don't know, but we do know in the meantime, there is no proactive agenda, whether it's from an, you know, anti-authoritarian perspective, or whether it's from a, you know, help the people perspective, or from a perspective of like, where do we go from here? All of that is out the window, and it's rather disturbing. But John, I appreciate your thoughts on this. I have a feeling we will touch base again, and hopefully we'll have something slightly different to report or talk about.
Sam, it is always such a deep pleasure to talk to you, and it keeps me a little bit sane in these crazy times.
Same, John. Always a pleasure. John Nichols, a pioneering political blogger, writes about politics for The Nation as its national affairs correspondent. His latest book is titled The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Why are risks such as obesity, smoking, hypertension, diabetes linked to a greater risk of death associated with COVID-19? Here to explain why communities hit the hardest by the coronavirus usually have higher risks and how we can reach out to these communities to improve overall health. My own doctor, in full disclosure, David LeMay. So, doctor, we should start off by telling you that I'm feeling fine. And I could probably use a better haircut. But aside from that, all is well with me. And I know you wanted to know that before we started.
I think most people are kind of returning to the home hairdos.
Indeed. Yes. All right. Well, so let's talk about this, because we're starting to see an incredible disparity in cohorts of people who are A, getting infected, and B, dying from the coronavirus. In Charlotte, North Carolina, it is only 33% African American, but African Americans make up about 44% of its coronavirus cases. In Michigan, African Americans account for 33% of cases, 40% of deaths in the state, despite only being 14% of the population. Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, only 26% African-American, yet African-Americans account for almost 50% of the coronavirus cases and 80% of the deaths. We see more of that in places like Chicago. We see that in places like Metro New York City. What's going on here?
One of the things that we are seeing is that in people that have comorbidities or they have other medical issues that are going on at the same time, they're struggling to fight this off. So if let's say you have a history of diabetes, or you have high blood pressure, or there's obesity. Those are the people that are struggling the most with this. And it's the younger people that tend to get sick that have the obesity issues. And it's the older patients that tend to be hypertensive or diabetic that are struggling with this and are not able to fight it off. So these people are, in some respects, they're immune compromised. So they don't have a normal functioning immune system because of the other comorbidities that they have where their immune system functions the way it's supposed to, where it handles the virus. You start to kill it off, produce antibodies to it, and then you get into a healing phase or what we call a resolution phase where you can start to repair damaged tissue. What's actually happening to some of these people is that their immune system also almost becomes overactive. So they begin producing an excess of what we call cytokines, which are just chemical messengers between these immune cells that calls in more immune cells. So they get this huge reaction, and it attacks multiple organs, although the obvious thing that you're hearing about is the attack on the lungs with the bilateral pneumonias and almost the suffocation feeling that a lot of these people get. And those are the patients that end up having the highest mortality rates.
And there's another factor, of course, here that we could delineate these discrepancies, I guess, in racial cohorts versus the amount of coronavirus infections and deaths. Or we could also use another lens here, too, which is income percentile. When we're looking in New York City, for instance, there are just simply far more cases amongst people whose income is in the bottom quartile of people. And it matches up almost perfectly. The lower on the income spectrum you are, the higher percentage of or higher numbers of cases exist.
Yep, absolutely. And in the Navajo Nation would be another example of that, where you have 40% of the population that doesn't even have access to running water or indoor plumbing. So how do you have hygiene, you know, to wash off the virus and protect other people if you don't even have access to that? So it's hitting lower incomes. It's hitting minorities harder. And if you look at the sort of situations, the living situations that many of these people are in, they live in tighter, or closer, communities where there's not as much spread in space. Many of these people are working in jobs that are considered, essential. So if you are, let's say, a janitor at a hospital and you are living with your parents and your wife and two kids in a one-bedroom apartment somewhere in New York, you're going to take a bus or a transit system or something back and forth to the hospital, and it does two things. One, it puts your whole family at risk, but it also puts other people at risk in transportation. But because you're so tightly packed together in that community, and chances are that these people are not eating super healthy, they're probably not doing the things that we would push people to do lifestyle wise to try to stay healthy, their risk goes way up. And educational levels play a role. Income plays a role. All of these things are what we're starting to see play out in this virus, and who is becoming the most affected, and what communities are the hardest hit.
Right. I mean, if you're living in some type of food desert, essentially, where you're getting your food from a mini mart or a bodega or something like that, your access to things like fresh vegetables and fruit is limited. Your access to all sorts of and I mean, it runs the gamut, right? I mean, but it seems to me, I mean, the the central driving force here is wealth inequality. I don't have to take public transport if I'm wealthy. I don't have to go to my job as a checkout person at the supermarket or at the hardware store, or I don't have to work for Instacart or wherever it is. If I'm wealthy, I am, I'm not living in cramped quarters. I'm maybe not, my parents can afford maybe to live on their own, and they're not necessarily living in the same place as me. I mean, all of these factors seems to me to be boiled down to income disparity. And in some respects, I feel like this is happening both in a health under like a plane of looking at this in terms of health, but also in terms of looking at this in terms of the sort of the health of our societal fabric, that coronavirus is basically the gas in the mine, and those folks who are marginalized are the canaries.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. We had no idea, I think, what to expect from this, or where it was going to hit, or what's going to happen. But as this information comes out, I think it's helpful to us to know this, right? So we know now where it's starting to hit, and we know what communities are starting to hit. And I think that allows us at least the opportunity to know where the resources need to go. Because if you just look and say, we've got 50 states and 50 governors and everybody gets equal, everybody gets the same thing treatment wise, everybody gets the same number of whatever, ventilators, PPE, whatever, that is probably not going to help us in solving this issue. I mean, right now, if we know this information, if we know where these communities are the hardest hit, it's going to help us to get into those communities, I think, at least. That should be the target, right? That we start looking at that and saying, okay, where we have the biggest issues with income inequality, as an example, or we have minority communities, and maybe even language barriers are an issue. Those are probably the communities we ought to look at and start to get resources into to try to help these people, and that helps everybody else. So, like you're saying, the canary in the coal mine. If we just kind of let them sink on their own, that means that the spread is probably going to continue. I think if you can, in effect, target those communities where you know it's the hardest hit and get the most resources into those communities and try to contain it and treat those people, you probably are saving everybody else from the same catastrophe.
There was a piece in the New York Times talking about how, at least in New York, there has been a surprising to local doctors, absence of, and not a total absence, but an absence of an inordinate amount or a disparate amount of people with asthma, which you would anticipate, right? Would
yep.
be,
yeah.
I mean, and what do you make of that? I mean, I, obviously you're doing this from a distance, and it's hard to say, but does it feel like, I mean, that we know more or less of this virus than you would have anticipated we would know by now?
I think that's the hard part, that it's fairly fresh for us. I mean, we're kind of looking at it maybe over the last 6 weeks once it basically started hitting us, and Italy was trying to figure it out. France was trying to figure it out. I think China was kind of a mix. There was some information coming out and some was being squelched. So we're behind the curve on how are we supposed to respond and who's supposed to get it. I mean, you would think if it's a lung issue that asthma would be a big component of the people that are affected by it. But yeah, we're not really necessarily seeing that. And I think that maybe has to do with again, where the receptor site is for where the virus attaches, that it's tied in a little bit more with cardiovascular disease than it is with an issue like asthma. I think if you look from and just to kind of give you a little background, my mindset on this stuff, I'm not an infectious disease guy. So I'm not the guy on the front lines that is trying to figure out everybody coming into the emergency room. So, but I'm a performance guy, work in the sports medicine world, and our mindset is a little bit different in how we see or view problems when we're dealing with performance. So instead of just saying, you know, symptom X equals treatment Y, we're looking at some basic principles. One is you have genetics that are involved, and that's the loaded gun. You can't do anything about your genetics, but it's everything around it that's going to pull the trigger. So this ties in with some of the community things that we were talking about, where in an environment where maybe there's heavy pollution, pollution seems to be involved, but we're not really necessarily correlating that with asthma. People whose diets probably are not, as you mentioned, you know, access to fresh vegetables and good clean foods is probably not as good for some of the lower privileged people in this country. So what do they have as resources for their immune system to fight this off? They're going to struggle with this. So you have lifestyle factors like exercise and sunlight exposure and, you know, vitamin D that seems to help balance the immune system, nutrients that may be helpful out of the diet, zinc and vitamin C, which are not necessarily things that we reach for as first line agents to say, hey, I'm going to treat this person in the emergency room with zinc. But when we're talking on the preventative side, if we're looking at risk factors, do any of these things play a role? I mean, does your nutritional deficit play a role in your chances of becoming sick? And I think all of that does. If I want an NBA player to be at their peak, I'm going to look at all these factors, right? I'm going to test for their nutrition. I want to make sure they're getting enough protein in the diet. They can, you know,
But they were obviously more exposed, but they did not seem to be a cohort of people, specifically the NBA, that seemed, you know, they seemed susceptible, right? I mean,
right.
Presumably, when you're talking about the NBA, you're talking about several hundred guys who are about in as good a shape as you can get, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yep, very, very good shape. Although I think it's a misconception that they are in perfect shape because they train so much and there's travel and they miss sleep. And so they're almost on the overtrained side in some circumstances that probably leads them in some circumstances to become a little bit immune compromised. So
interesting.
Yeah. And that's what we have to fight on our end is how do we handle that? But in this circumstance, I mean, there were some guys, right? A couple players with Utah. You know, their center Rudy Gobert kind of, unfortunately, I think, you know, had the misconception that they couldn't get it. And that was, you know, he kind of made a joke about it, which he apologized for. I'm sure he felt horrible for, but, there were some players that became infected and then everybody in the league kind of clamped down and said, okay, we're going to have massive spread if we don't do something. And that was sort of the beginning of, at least on the sports world side, saying, okay, we can't just let this ride and keep going. But
yeah,
but
I think that pushed, I mean, frankly, if the NBA doesn't shut down when it does, mm-hmm. I'm afraid that we are probably looking at nationwide, and certainly in New York, thousands of more deaths.
I agree.
I think. I mean, because there was a real reluctance to shut this down, and the NBA shutting down, I think, was the moment where I think people's sense that this is serious crystallized.
Yes.
And so I think in many respects, I think we'll look back to that moment when the NBA in particular shut down as sort of maybe potentially saving thousands of lives, because in New York, we missed the threshold by literally, you know, a tiny, tiny bit in terms of busting through the number of ICU beds that
yes.
existed there. And I think if they had shut down New York City a couple of days later, if people in New York, you know, hadn't seen what happened with the NBA, that's when people started to sort of say, like, hey, wait a second, this could be real. And it had a big import. Well, Dr. Dave LeMay, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and great to talk to you again, Sam.
You too. Dr. David LeMay is board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation, focuses on metabolic nutrition and training to help prevention, recovery, and performance. How do we solve misinformation when it comes to news shared on popular social media outlets such as Facebook? Well, here to discuss his group's investigation that shows how Facebook has failed to protect millions of users from misinformation and why these platforms need to take steps to control fake news. Fadi Karan, campaign director for Avaaz. So, Fadi, let's start with just outlining for us what this academic study shows. Because, you know, and we should say that Facebook in particular, but also in Google, in the news this week, they have been Australian government has basically said they have to pay for news content. Then there's a flip side of that, which is the arguably news content or not news content that portrays itself as news. But talk about this research conducted by Ethan Porter of George Washington University.
Yes. So the first piece of research, and there are two pieces of research here. One is about the coronavirus-related misinformation that's been spreading. What the research finds, it looks at 100 samples of misinformation. Of course, there are thousands of samples out there, and our organization monitors, you know, thousands of pieces of content. But we decided to just take one sample and look to see how many people it had reached. And what the study there found is that only 100 posts of misinformation. These are harmful things that can make people sick, like taking chlorine dioxide will heal you from the coronavirus, or drinking water and garlic will make you immune to the disease. And those types of posts, just 100 posts, were shared 1.7 million times and viewed 117 million times. And that's the tip of the iceberg. So the first thing here is that this misinformation is going viral on the platform, and Facebook is its epicenter. The other big thing that this study showed was that Facebook's current moderation policies, so Facebook gets excited about speaking about how they're putting fact checks up when they detect misinformation, or how they're taking down harmful coronavirus content. And what our study shows is that these efforts by Facebook are extremely delayed. So millions of people, we found that in our sample, which are all fact-checked pieces of misinformation, 4 out of 10 were not labeled. They were not fact-checked and they were not removed. So 40% of already fact-checked content is staying on the platform. And we found for the remaining 60%, most of it is delayed when they fact-check it, or delayed before they remove it. It could take a week, sometimes up to 3 weeks.
Let me just reiterate that. So yes, 40% of the stuff that they fact-checked is never removed, and 60% is removed, but it's removed after a week or so, which, based upon the speed in which this information travels, it means it's hit a ton of people already.
Exactly. And you can imagine, Sam, that in the midst of this pandemic, where people are sitting at home looking for facts, trying to figure out what to do, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fear, they're on their phones being flooded with these lies that, if you believe them, if you even if just 10% of people believe these lies, they could make you do something that is not only harmful to yourself, but that is also harmful to your family and your community. And that's why we wanted to do this study, to show that, you know, Facebook and, you know, is promising to take a lot of steps to fight this type of content. So are other platforms, but the steps they're currently taking are not enough. And at the heels of this report, Facebook decided to take an important step, which is to start alerting people when they see that they had seen harmful misinformation content about COVID-19. The problem is Facebook's alert, at least on how they're currently designed, are not enough to truly inform people. And that's the other study you mentioned by Ethan Porter and Tom Wood that we commissioned. That study shows that if you present people with sophisticated corrections, sophisticated fact checks, then you can decrease the number of people who believe this information by up to 50% and sometimes more. But Facebook is not implementing that solution, just implementing, you know, a small part of it.
Okay. So, I mean, let's take these two things separately. And we should just say that, and I don't know, I imagine there is research out there about first impressions, right? I mean, how, and this obviously is implicated in the second study, which talks about like how what's involved in shaking people's belief of fake news. But I can tell you that just there was a separate study done this week at the University of Chicago. It's a working paper, fair enough. But they compared the viewership of Sean Hannity relative to Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson took coronavirus seriously. Sean Hannity said it was a hoax up until, I don't know, very close to the shutdowns for everybody, maybe even through that on some level. And there are now clusters of death that correlate to where Hannity outperforms Tucker Carlson. Again, working paper, but it's more indication of the implications of getting false news that you take it seriously and you don't go back and necessarily check on it on some level unless there's some type of intervention. So when you did this second study that to determine if you can reverse it, because and at the end of this, I want to really have a more, you know, have a frank conversation about what Facebook's game is here, because this is not a story, it seems to me, of incompetence. But it's important to establish that you can mitigate the impact of this on some level. So let's talk about that mitigation. There are multiple examples of basically providing corrections that you guys did in this study that show you, like you say, you can cut the understanding of the misinformation in half. Still rather dangerous, but it's something anyways. What was involved in that process, though? Was it sitting people down and forcing them to read this? Like, can you do it without having control of a certain group of people, like force their eyeballs on this stuff?
So the way we designed the study was to mimic as closely as possible the user's experience on Facebook. So we designed a website called factbook.org that looks pretty much just like Facebook. And 2,000 Americans through YouGov, is like academic research unit, 2,000 Americans were randomly chosen. And what we asked them to do is we gave them a news feed that looks exactly like the Facebook news feed, and we had them go through that news feed. Now, for some of the people in the study, they just saw normal Facebook posts, you know, pictures of people's dogs, stuff like that. For another part of the group, they saw a normal Facebook news feed, but it had misinformation stories, misinformation posts there. And they were real misinformation posts, not ones that we created. They were ones we actually found online. For example, one claiming that the measles outbreak in the U.S. was due to the illegal immigration. And then there, you know, a group of people not only saw the, after the people went through this news feed, people were then later asked to go through another news feed that looks like Facebook. And this news feed had a list of corrections in it. So it would say, you know, alert, it seems like you've previously seen misleading information. And then they'd have a post that shows them, it would say, you know, on day X, you saw a post claiming that the measles outbreak was due to Y. This post has been proven false by the AP fact checkers and factchecks.org. This post was actually put out by this person. It explained, not only told people that this post was false, it gave them the correction. So also said the measles outbreak in the U.S. is due to, you know, certain population clusters not taking vaccinations. So what we found is then for those 2,000 people, we simply asked them a true or false question. And what we found is that people who saw the corrections, 50% less of them believed the misinformation. So the reason the study that was put out is so important is that it actually looks just like Facebook. So we can make the claim that if these corrections were put on Facebook, the results would largely be similar. They could even be better at Facebook because Facebook has a better design team. And that's why we feel confident in saying that this solution works on social media, and particularly on the Facebook newsfeed. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that does. So let me ask you this. I mean, with essentially, and you're basically mocking the experience of Facebook and trying to sort of recreate that experience and how it would work if Facebook actually provided these corrections. But let me ask you this: like, with all that said, were you shocked that it was only 50%? I mean, you know, it cuts both ways. Like, on one hand, like, oh, okay, 50%, that's good, that's a good thing. But on the other hand, it's like, what's it going to take? I mean, the authority that they responded to was theoretically identical to the authority that basically said to them, hey, you rely on us for information. What you saw was fake. But they were still like, I'm going to choose to believe the fake thing more. Sorry.
Well, it actually, the results were not exactly like that. So, number one, a good amount of people, between 25 to 30%, answered, I don't know. And when we went back to those who answered, I don't know, or those who even answered, you know, the wrong answer, they still believe the false news. The main reason they gave us about, you know, a majority of the people who gave the wrong answer or didn't know the right answer, even after seeing the correction, what they told us is this. They said, yeah, we saw the correction, but we have never heard of Facebook doing these types of fact checks. So we didn't know whether to trust it or not, because it just looked so new to us. So our estimation, based on our continued testing, is that if Facebook actually announces to people and says, we're going to be working with independent fact checkers to send you a fact check, so if you see this on your newsfeed, you can trust it, the results would be much better. Probably an internal kind of test we've done later, out of us with our numbers, we got up to 80 to 82% of people believing the correction. So we can definitely improve and decrease the level of uncertainty. The other important bit here that I think is key is that, you know, because people always say, oh, you're always going to have a group who believes the misinformation or who believes the lies. And that's true. You're always going to have a, you know, ideological or dogmatic group within any society who are always going to believe that, right, you know, vaccinations cause autism. But those people who continue to be a minority, their goal, the reason they use social media, is to spread their kind of misinformation, their lies, like a virus. And the goal of this is to really, the people who are in between, the people who don't know enough about the topic, the goal is to quarantine them against that misinformation. And one interesting thing I'll add that this study found is there was a subset of the study group that neither saw the misinformation, the lies, nor did they see, you know, the correction. They were just people who saw a normal Facebook news feed. And the people who saw the misinformation plus the correction actually performed better in knowing what's true from false than the people who saw neither the misinformation nor the correction, which is another indication that having these corrections is more kind of useful and more effective. So again, these studies, this research needs to go on. But you can really kind of, if designed well, you can really benefit society with it.
And I guess that last point you're making is that on some level, as you expose people more to this, they become savvier readers of information in some way. That it becomes a there's a certain, I guess, feedback loop in terms of developing the muscles once you see examples of this. All right. So with that said, if we stipulate that there's been research that shows that misinformation can be corrected, can be combated, that you can't maybe eliminate 100% of its implications, but you can eliminate a significant portion of its implications. Is this ultimately just about putting pressure on Facebook because by basically taking off the table one of their excuses? Because I'm beginning to become of the mind that there's a reason why this stuff is so prominent on Facebook, and that is because they have a financial incentive to have this on Facebook. That conflict, that stories that are shocking, that all of this stuff, even controversial because it's fake, actually creates profits for them. And that if they really wanted to have, you know, get rid of it, they could hire human beings instead of relying on algorithms, but that would be too costly and they don't want to start that precedent. And if they had human beings, then they might have less of an excuse as to why they don't want to take this stuff down. I mean, is that really at the end of the day, like, do we really anticipate that Facebook is going to change their business model? Or is it, this is a way to inspire lawmakers to say, hey, Facebook has a business model that is never going to disavow them of this practice of essentially allowing fake news to flourish?
That's a great question. And the answer to it is a bit nuanced based on our experience. And it differs from social media platform to social media platform. I think Facebook particularly does have a problem, which is that they need to, what we call, detox the algorithm, which is redesign their algorithm so they're more focused on, you know, healthy social engagement instead of giving incentive to outrageous content. You know, the algorithms kind of learn through machine learning and other artificial intelligence. Facebook tells the algorithm to largely learn, how do you keep people online the longest and engage the longest so that they see the most ads? And YouTube and Twitter and others do the same thing. What the platforms need to do is to redesign, to detoxify their algorithms, to make them better for society. And there's a big debate about how to do that. And a lot of people argue that the only way to do that is through regulation, because you have a type of new form of, you know, what some call surveillance capitalism that can't be fixed without strong regulation. On the other hand, based on our experience with Facebook, there are teams at Facebook, you know, their integrity team, they have a misinformation team that really work hard and are testing some of the solutions that you and I are talking about. And those people are great people that are committed to solving this problem. Why doesn't Facebook move faster? One reason may be that it's not about the financial aspect, because that's something that they can, it won't really harm them if they really begin implementing corrections the way we're talking about. It could actually benefit them because it increases trust in the platform, is what we're finding. But the main reason is that you have politicians around the world, you know, Bolsonaro, Moody, a number of politicians, both local and at national level here in the U.S., who benefit from misinformation campaigns, who benefit from political disinformation. And Facebook, at the executive level, not at the level of people trying to solve these problems, but at the executive level, appears to be kind of unwilling, or have made the calculation that if we really go strong on these solutions, it could cause us a lot of trouble with some of these misinformation actors. So it's better not to move at scale, at the scale necessary to solve this issue, because we don't want to rock the boat. And it seems to be like YouTube and to a large extent Twitter and have taken a similar decision of not really challenging this misinformation and disinformation phenomena, which, you're right, is premeditated in many cases. It's not just a random person wanting to spread rumors. It's people who designed these lives to have political and social impact, and the platforms do not want to go head in head towards them. And this is where we think the kind of both research and advocacy and social pressure and media pressure is important to get the platforms to act.
Well, I agree with that, and I also have to confess that I am cynical enough to be a little skeptical about the Facebook executives who are afraid of providing fact-checking in this country because they're afraid of Bolsonaro, or they're afraid of some other, you know, I don't know, Orban or whoever they want to say is the one that's really holding them back. at the end of the day, one way or another, this has to be fixed. And if it and this research, at the very least, provides a one element in pushing back on Facebook's exclamations that, you know, there's not, we're doing everything we can do about it. Well, they're not. Fadi, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And if I can add,
please,
just a couple of points. Maybe I'm too optimistic on this front, but you know, when we began working on this 2 years ago, Facebook told us that providing fact check correction on any content was impossible, and it was too big of an ask, and it was something they wouldn't do. You know, last year in October, they unveiled, you know, labeling, putting warning labels on misinformation content due to pressure and due to societal pressure and also due to threats of regulation coming from the EU and other countries. And then, you know, Facebook told us, okay, this is as far as we'll go, but we'll never send everybody a correction to all misinformation they're seeing because retroactive corrections are impossible to do and they're a headache and we can't technically do them. And then this research came out forward in the midst of this pandemic, and it created a precedent where they had to retroactively inform people. So I do think you're right. Facebook won't, and none of the platforms will move unless they're pushed and put in a corner to act. But I don't think that it's impossible to get them to act. And the other point is on the 50%, and we're always pushing for more, and we think we can achieve more. But 50% of people believing or not believing this information can shift an election, and it can shift a swing state. And that's why, even if it's just 50%, even if it's 30%, Facebook needs to implement this before the U.S. 2020 election, because otherwise Russia and other disinformation actors can come in, use this information, and switch, you know, influence people to switch their votes. And Facebook can protect people against that, and its responsibility is to do so.
Fadi Karan, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam, and I hope you guys have a great day.
Fadi Karan is the campaign director for Avaaz. You can find out more information over at avaaz.org. That's avaaz.org. And that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Thanks so much to all of our free podcast subscribers that have converted into members to help support this show. We've recently left radio, and of course, COVID-19 is cutting into our ability to sell ads. So I cannot thank you enough. It is our members who make this show possible. If you're listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream every day at noon, covering all the biggest news stories of the day and some long-form interviews with authors and policymakers and whatnot. Don't forget, of course, the AM Quickie. It's available at amquickie.com. 6 minutes, headlines in the morning to get your day started off right. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. And maybe we